Is there a secret to making a high click-through rate product or a high converting product?
For me, it's how easy do you make it to consume the information on your listings? Your main image is like your 70, 80% of your success, right? Because that's what's going to get you or not get you the clicks. And no clicks, no traffic, no sales.
How do you survive Amazon? Welcome to Surviving Amazon, the podcast that exposes the brutal truth behind selling on Amazon. It's a war zone and only the strongest survive. We bring you insider stories and strategies from experts and sellers who have been through it all, the ups, the downs, and the moments that made them question, to be honest, if it was even all worth it. I'm Johnny Bradley, and we're joined today by Matt Costan. He's fought through the madness of selling online for a number of years, as well as selling on Amazon, doing multiple millions along the way. And in 2022, he co-founded Product Pinion. It's a tool for Amazon sellers that help them increase revenue by leveraging customer insights and even recording the screen as people shop, which is pretty spooky the first time you kind of see it. He's lived it, he's survived it, and he's here to share exactly how he did it. So Matt, my first question to you is, how do you survive Amazon?
Yeah, no, that's the million-dollar question, literally. For me, I mean, I think it's also a big part of that is just like how to survive entrepreneurship. And the biggest thing obviously is, you know, understanding that shit will go wrong, whether it's Amazon, whether it's, doesn't matter what business you're in. And then just being able to roll with the punches. I mean, at the end of the day, you have to be resilient. It's true. If you're on Amazon, especially, like, you have to realize that you're working with a third party platform and you have to play their game. But I still think the value is there to be able to get started really quickly and easily so that you start building your brand, your empire, even like outside of Amazon. So the way to survive Amazon is basically like be on it, but then think outside of it to grow into something much, much bigger.
Totally. And because there are lots of rules, regulations, and Amazon can go see you later very quickly. And it makes sense to push your stuff off of Amazon. But I guess a lot of people, and you've been doing this for years now, and I've been in this space for 7 or 8 years at this point, and I've seen a lot of people come and go. They start up their products, they have maybe an initial success over the first few months, let's say, and then everything slowly tapers off and the sales decrease and they have to reduce their marketing spend, and it like quote fails, right? It's not a massive failure, but they don't get the success that they need. How does someone turn that around? Is there something that they can do? Or where do you see the big problem for sellers?
Yeah, so I mean, like, it's very rare that you'll get an overnight success. So you're like launching something and then it just kind of blows up. I mean, it can happen still. I've seen it happen. But you also have to realize that, obviously it takes, you know, sometimes it's positioned as like, you know, you put it on Amazon, it'll sell. Maybe that was true like 15 years ago where it was the Wild West. Now it does take some more energy and effort into making a successful brand. I mean, when it boils down to it, I mean, a couple things. So one is, you know, don't go in it alone. So make sure that you have a community. Obviously Amazon has their support, but there's like a lot to be desired with Amazon support. So being in touch with peers that have either, you know, maybe they're a step, 2 steps, 5 steps ahead of you, just to get that encouragement, but then also like that support when something goes wrong. But then also, I mean, at the end of the day, what's foundational is your product. And if your product is actually not great or hasn't been well thought of, and if you haven't kind of got an understanding of, you know, what shoppers want, you're in for a world of pain where, no one wants to sell something that nobody wants, right? So doing that prior research, doing that prior kind of getting that understanding of what will actually resonate with shoppers will go a long way for being successful on Amazon or any platform. Someone had once told me that like marketing is the expense for a product that's unremarkable, and that kind of stuck with me, and that was kind of like one of my foundational thoughts of like, well, hey, how can I make sure that I'm making a remarkable product that I don't have to spend an arm and a leg to get the attention? And it kind of almost gets the attention just for being an amazing thing that people actually want to buy.
Well, that kind of brings up the question then is, if do I go for having the most incredible product, right? And maybe spend more on the product and then not worry so much about marketing because it's going to sell itself. Because sometimes I think to myself, I could have, this is my personal belief, right? I could have the best product, but if it's marketed terribly and no one sees it, then I'm not going to make any money, right? It'll have to happen through word of mouth, which may be slower growth. Is it sometimes better to say, well, what if I just have a good product? Maybe it's not the most amazing. I have a good product, but I market it so much better than everyone else's. Like, what do you think about that?
Yeah, I mean, both approaches work. I mean, I think having a good product is, like, today is just the cost of entry. Like, you have to be at least good. And I would, I would strive for both. Like, obviously, yeah, you got to spend the marketing dollars too. But I feel like there's a way to do it where you can also have word of mouth kind of built into the marketing strategies. But I definitely think you want to work on having that good product. Try to make it as remarkable as possible by differentiating, not just different. I think one of the mistakes that a lot of sellers get into is they'll differentiate a product, but will they differentiate it in a way that matters? So there's a big difference, right? Like, some people will just change a thing for the sake of changing a thing or including a little accessory thing. But to a shopper, do they actually care? And if the answer is no, then it's probably wasted. Now, meanwhile, you could make a small change to a product that actually makes a difference in a shopper's life, that they'll be like, yes, this, I want this thing, and be really successful with it. And that turns, like, a good product into an amazing one. But it really comes down to understanding what is the change that you're going to make, that, and will it actually resonate and matter to the people that are buying at the end of the day.
So that's kind of basically saying, like, hey, have empathy for the people that are actually giving you the money, right? And I think maybe, I don't know, 5, 6, 7 years ago, a lot of people, oh, just bundle an ebook, put an ebook with it. And that's a way to stand out. And I always had a bit of an issue with that, thinking, well, why? Why the hell should we, if it's not going to get used, what's the point? If it's just to get a click, can we not get a click in another way and put something else in the hero image that is going to get that attention, rather than give someone something that they're not going to use? And actually, is going to cost money to create. It's maybe a physical product that, again, is going to cost money. What's the point? When we look back over the years, and a lot of people kind of still do it this way, they look at the reviews and they look at purchase products that are similar to the, you know, people add to the basket as well. And they think, oh, well, I'll take these reviews and I'll just do what people want from what they're saying here. And maybe I'll bundle it with this product, or, and that's going to be my strategy. You've been doing something a little bit different for a long time, way before product opinion, and that's about leveraging customer insights pre-purchase, right? Now, I think this is something that in the Amazon space, we've not seen a huge amount of it, other than, like, with you guys and a handful of other people, right? And it's quite an alien topic to think about. People don't think about this when they do Amazon. In other businesses, doing market research is, like, normal. Like, it's totally normal to do that.
Standard.
For some reason, yeah. Right? Like, people come to Amazon, they're like, oh, no, I'll just look at some reviews. How did that come about? Talk us through the journey of how you created this system of leveraging customer insights. And what does that even mean?
Yeah, totally. So, I mean, if we really go back, so one of the things I was involved with back in the day was with Groupon. And with Groupon, it was interesting. I mean, everything was drop shipped, right? So people, and for those that don't know Groupon, it was basically one of those big daily, I mean, I think everyone knows Groupon, but it was a daily deal site. They had a deal for, at the start, it was for services like massages, whatever. And then they started getting into products. And with the products, it was like every 2-3 days, we were able to kind of give them a drop shipping deal on a certain product. And most of these products were unbranded, they're just generic stuff. But the interesting thing was, you know, I was sending out, I basically had my hand in every single category of product you could imagine we were selling on Groupon. And doing that, it was almost like rapid fire, not really split testing, but we were able to kind of get a feel for, you know, the kinds of products, kinds of deals that people were resonating with. And one of the things that was a big game changer for us was there was a particular watch we were selling. And, you know, first deal that we did with this watch, it was just a generic watch. And then I had the idea to name it something specific. So basically just brand it, right? And after branding it, then people could easily talk about it more. And the branded deal did, almost two times more. Even though it came out later, the branded deal did actually better than unbranded. And it was literally me just creating a name out of thin air, right? So that was one of the aha moments for me back in the day. But then on top of that, I was really into buying things on Kickstarter. So Kickstarter is where someone puts an idea forth, and if you like the idea, you kind of give them money. It's like a pre-order in advance of getting it. And I was thinking, well, hey, like all this experience with Groupon, that sort of stuff, like I kind of have an idea of what people, kind of products, that sort of thing. So I figured, you know what? I'm going to try this Kickstarter thing. And I was hooked. Like Kickstarter was insane. It was basically like getting all the insights you could ever want and basically develop a product in public in real time, and be able to, be able to create something with a community. And it kind of resonated with me to the point where I was like, yeah, having these insights is everything. At the time, I was using also a software called usertesting.com. They're huge, right? They're like a $2 billion company. And what they allowed you to do is actually send someone your URL, your Amazon. Really, it was meant for software development at the time. It was like show somebody your software and then ask them how they get stuck or what they expect when they click that button, that sort of thing. But I was using it on my Amazon listings. So I was like, hey, tell me what you find confusing. Tell me what I can do better. Or like, is there anything that, why wouldn't you buy this product? Or why wouldn't you recommend this to somebody else? And it was wild, the insights that I got from that, to the point where it was like, hey, Amazon sellers, or I mean any e-commerce sellers, could really use user testing for their listings, for their products, for their brands. So that's kind of where that kind of came to be, and kind of where Productpinion kind of started. With my co-founder Andre, he was actually building a brand that he now exited, where he did this similar thing where he was he basically built a Facebook group, a very interactive and responsive Facebook group around his product, and he would be asking them questions. He would kind of be like developing new products with them, and then we kind of connected over that, and then that's where we kind of got together to make Productpinion happen. And it all came from basically actual experience selling e-commerce, doing the things that everyone's doing to build a platform that really helps, everyone to get the insights that the Fortune 500 companies get and do on a regular basis.
I think, first of all, from a seller's perspective, you think, oh my God, user testing, surveying, or that sounds like, first of all, oh, it sounds like a lot of work. It sounds really expensive. Can I not just take the easy route and go on Helium 10 and click, oh, I've got 100 reviews? And I think the argument for that is like, well, if everyone's doing that, then you should definitely be doing this, right? You should definitely do it, because not that many people go, okay, well, let's build this based on the feedback that we're getting. And I think in the past, before you guys existed, we would do this: go and ask your friends and say, go and put this in the group chat with your mates. And this is what we would do all the time, like trying to find more people that we don't know. Is, it only goes so far when you're like, I've exhausted all of the people that I can ever ask without getting biased results. And what we always found is that the data that we got back from that was crazy, crazy good, because they'd all choose option B and we think option C is the best. And we're like, oh, damn, like, why was that? Why did they choose that logo? Why did they choose that hero image or that product? Why did they choose that one? And then you can ask those follow-up questions. But I think that's always been, like, for us, a really laborious, horrible process that is a bit of a pain. So when you guys come along, I'm like, oh my God, this is, I wish, in honestly, I wish I came up with it, right? I wish I did it.
Yeah, that was just the idea, right? Like how to make it easy, like how to make it, you almost want to do the testing, almost like my goal is to make it so that testing's fun. You do a couple clicks, you're good to go, you get the information that you need. And a big part of that, like I've also been in software for 10 plus years too. So knowing how to make software that's not just good for the end user, which is obviously really important, what I found, you know, with developing product opinion, what's even more important is making sure that the interface for the shopper is bang on as well. And what I'm really proud of is we get comments from shoppers that will use, you know, usertesting.com, and then they'll also use product opinion, and they'll actually write to us and be like, hey, yeah, I use user testing, but your interface is better. It's easier. Mm-hmm. And it's like, holy shit, that's, you know, a $2 billion company, and they can do anything that they want, right? And we're making something that, you know, is easier to use for on the shopper side. Because obviously they make it easier for the shoppers. They're going to give you better feedback. They're going to want to keep doing product opinion surveys and that sort of thing. So that's something that I'm really, really proud of as well.
No, it's great. And I think what you've developed is super, super useful, which is why I talk about it. And I implore people to actually go and check it out and do search simulation testing to not only test their existing products to see how they can get higher click-through rates, higher conversion rates, analyze their competitors. What I really wanted to ask is, from your perspective, and you've seen a lot of products, like you see the back-end stuff, is there a secret to making a high click-through rate product or a high converting product? Is there a secret?
Yeah, exactly. Just do this magic wand and you're done.
Yeah.
That's a great question. So every niche is different, every product's different, but there are common things that kind of make sense. And a lot of it is just rooted in, you know, psychology and rooted in, like, for me, it's how easy do you make it to consume the information on your listings? And that's for conversion, right? So, I mean, we can start with clicks. Your main image is like your 70, 80% of your success, right? Because that's what's going to get you or not get you the clicks. And no clicks, no traffic, no sales. So there's a ton of things that you can do on the main image. And a lot of people will kind of, you know, come up with the main image, set it and forget it, which is a big mistake. That you should be working on your image all the time, even throughout the season. So, you know, the holiday season, you know, you can do something, we like to call it, you know, festivize your main image, add a little holiday element to it. And the psychology around that is just that when people start, I mean, it's why the stores do it, right? Like you start hearing Christmas music, like in October, it makes people think about gift giving. And even if your product, it's interesting, because even if your product is not a typical gifting product, doing something like that still can help increase sales, and it's an easy excuse to kind of test the
saying that then people will go, if you can do something, oh, actually I will buy this for my, maybe I'm not going to buy this for myself, but I'm going to buy it for my friends or my mom or my dad or my sister because it's got a little gift. But it's like a subconscious thing.
Potentially, yeah. I mean, the main thing would be like, hey, can you put something on your main image that will stand out in the search results? So maybe yours has the red bow or ribbon or whatever it might be. You're catching the eye. You're doing some pattern interruption, right? And pattern interruption is another concept that I love talking about. Basically, like when everyone does one thing, what you'll also find on Amazon is like sellers just copy other sellers because they don't know what else they should be doing. So if they're in a category and they're, you know, whatever it is they're selling, everyone's on the same angle, like all the shots are on the same angle or they're all straight forward or whatever it might be. A lot of that is, yeah, people just follow other people because they think like, oh, they're doing it. They're doing so well. Look at their sales. I can go into Helium 10, see the sales. They must be doing something right. I'm just going to copy it. That's probably actually, you know, back to the first question of how do you survive Amazon? It's basically not doing all the things that your competitors are doing, and you want to figure out how do I interrupt a pattern? How do I do something different? So anything you can do to stand out in the crowd is going to help big time for you to get the attention and get the get the click.
I think what you said is a good point, especially when someone's starting, they just do what everyone else does, thinking, well, this is the norm, this is how it should be, and it's not the case. You know, very simply, you can go through, and now you can get GPTs to kind of do this for you a bit, but, and I know you guys have got one for this, but you can just go and go, right, how many out of the top 15 have packaging? You know, note them down. How many, you know, have black packaging? Note them down. How many are facing left, facing right with a top down angle or a 45? And you just log all of the things and then go, right, if everyone's doing this, what's the complete opposite? I think where you guys come in and take this to the next level is you go, okay, cool. Let's make this image. And rather than push it to Amazon and see the results, because the results could get worse if we push this to Amazon, right? Which we don't want. We don't want our BSR. We want our ranking to get better on keywords. And if we're doing this for a week or 2 weeks of testing and it goes worse, I mean, we've lost out on sales. So you come in and go, right, let's test this offline, bringing people in, surveying them and say, which one would you click on? If you see a positive result, then hey, look, we'll post that to Amazon and we'll see if the data comes in and aligns with that. And I remember I did I released a book, and this was like 4 years ago now. We were doing Facebook ads, Instagram ads and stuff like that. And there's a picture of me holding the book, right? All I did, and this was one of the best performing ads we had, is I just turned it upside down so that I was upside down holding a book. That was it. And it worked so incredibly well because it was this scrolling through Instagram and they're like, oh, fuck, what the hell? And they, what's going on? Turn it upside down, pattern interrupt. And that was enough to get people to pay attention to that advert and then obviously go on to the next page. So I always think, you know, how can we capture that attention? And maybe we can't put something upside down on Amazon, but we can certainly try and stick out like a sore thumb, like one of your products. You literally try to stick out like a sore thumb as being a sore thumb, and it works. You know, it really does work.
Yeah, and just to expand on that example, it was basically, so that was the mosquito repellent bracelet where everyone in the niche would basically have these bracelets stacked, obviously isolated on white, super colorful. And then I consciously made the decision to actually put the bracelet on someone's hand and give them the thumbs up. So in the search results, it was impossible to miss the thumbs up, right? And that's one of the products that went on to do like well over $1 million in a very short period of time, in part due to that. That's the name of the game. Like, how do you stick out? How do you get the attention? At least to get the click. That's to get your initial traffic to the listing. I was also going to mention too, there was an interesting case study with a client. It was a really big client using Product Pinion. And then obviously the bigger you grow, the bigger the risk is when you make worse decisions, right? So in their case, I can't remember if it was around 5,000 or 10,000, but it was like a substantial loss that they had. Basically, what they were doing before was like, hey, let's just test some random image ideas, which is better than nothing, because overall their net was much higher when they were testing. But there was one particular case where the image performed worse, and they actually saw like a significant, I think it was over $5,000 loss because of that change. And then for kicks, we kind of ran it in Product Pinion just to see, and Product Pinion in 15 minutes would have told them the same result, that wasn't something that they should be, you know, putting onto Amazon. So the numbers obviously get bigger as you grow the brand, but that was a painful.
Sometimes you got to learn by being burned, right? And, you know, we know the fire's hot, but when you're new, you're like, well, I need to kind of touch it just to double check that it is hot, right? And once people realize that these changes that we're making, you know, they might not go well, even a title change, you know, moving a keyword in a title, you know, let's just check it. Before we do it, let's just check to see if this makes a difference on click-through rate, if it reduces it, if it makes it better. You know, I did that test, you know, that one with the splat map that I think you guys have seen, and we put at the very end, the last three words, and super cool. And it was really interesting in the feedback from Product Pinion is everyone was saying, oh, not super cool, super cute. And everyone said, oh, I really like the cute design. Cute, 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 kept coming up. And my opinion was, before going into that test, that this isn't going to have a difference. It's the last word on the title. The more we use these tools and the more we see the response, the more I know that I don't know anything. I don't know if something's going to work. I don't know if it's not going to work. My opinion means absolute dog shit nothing. And Matt, unfortunately, yours is also means nothing as well. Like, no one person really makes a difference.
Nothing. Absolutely.
Literally nothing, 100%. Right? And I did a talk a while ago, and we talk about this in like our academy about the law of large numbers. And I know that you'll know this. The law of large numbers is the more times you repeat an experiment, the more accurate the results become to the predicted amount, right? So if it's a coin flip, you expect it to be 50-50, but if you flip a coin three times, it might land heads twice and tails once, therefore it's not 50-50. If we do it 10,000 times, then hey, it's probably going to be 5,000 and one times heads, you know, 4,900. And this is the problem when we're asking ourselves. Let's say you have a business partner. Hey, do you like this new hero image? Do you think it's really cool? They're like, yeah, I think it's really cool. I think it's going to do well. Okay, let's push it to Amazon and see what it does. And I think that's where the nerdy side of like Amazon comes in. Would you say that that's where a lot of sellers are going wrong?
For sure. Yeah. I mean, I mean, it's about statistical significance, right? So, I mean, asking 10 people with two options, it's as good as asking one person something. I mean, qualitative feedback is different. I mean, sure, you can get qualitative feedback from the 10, but if you want an actual answer of like, how sure are you that this option is over this option? Mm-hmm. You have to ask a significant number of people general rule of thumb that we practice in product opinion is 50 shoppers per option. So if you have two options, you want to ask at least 100 people. Now, that being said, you don't necessarily have to ask 100. You can start off with less. Something unique we do in our platform is you can always add more people later. But the whole idea is you want to make sure that what people, you know, when you're doing any kind of ask or survey, you want to make sure that, you know, the results aren't just because of luck. You want to be able to repeat it. And when you hit a statistical significance of, so in science, you want to get like a 99% statistical significance. When you're working in marketing, I feel like 85 is okay. What that basically means, when you have an 85% statistical significance, it means 85% of the time you repeat this test, you'll get the same result. So that's a pretty good indicator that, you know, this image or this variation is more likely to perform better than the other one.
Amazing. So it's making sure that you're doing the right testing. So what I see a lot of people do is they will change their hero image in a variety, in a multitude of different ways. They'll change all their imagery and maybe their title all at the same time, right? And then something goes wrong and they go, what happened? Obviously this hasn't worked. Let's change it all back. And they're back to square one and they don't know what actually made the detrimental impact. It could have been that all of their imagery actually made a positive improvement, but their title ruined everything. So is there a best practice that you would say when people are going through the testing, how they should approach that from a step-by-step process?
Yeah, absolutely. So basically you want to like test one variable at a time, right? You can't, if you're changing multiple things, it's called multivariable testing. You can do that, but then you need like, it gets much more scientific and you need like thousands of people to be exposed to the different combinations of options to figure out which options make the difference. So yeah, general rule of thumb, test one thing at a time. And then to expand on that, a lot of people have to understand is that your click-through rate is relative to your competition. So it's not enough to just make a beautiful main image. You could have the most gorgeous main image, pixel perfect to the T, but if it doesn't stand out amongst your competition, then you lose. It doesn't matter how beautiful it is. So that's why we have what we call like true Amazon search simulation. So we're the only ones that actually can mock up an Amazon search page and actually have people, you know, select the option in the context as if it was on Amazon. And also what's important is, you know, people seeing ratings, pricing, reviews, the title makes a big difference, right? All of those components can help. So, you know, when testing the main image, I would have all of those components there to make sure that you're not getting false positives. You can do concept testing. So for example, if you're trying to come up with, you know, three different ideas for your main image, like this main image will have, you know, maybe whatever, right? A, B, C, but then you do want to take those concepts and put them into context testing to make sure that it's actually making a difference with your competitors there, with the pricing, with everything else. And then the last step is, you know, with product opinion, we call the strategy high tempo testing. So in like 15 minutes, you're getting results. Once you get the results in product opinion, then you know, hey, this is worthwhile for me to put onto Amazon's manager experiments tool, where that tool takes like, you know, take 4 weeks, 5 weeks, but then you're actually seeing how it affects the numbers. But I would always do the high tempo testing first to make sure whatever you put into that Amazon tool is worth the time invested, and you're putting your best foot forward when you're testing that way. And that's the full kind of funnel of testing. So concept, context, and then onto Amazon to see how it affects, you know, real life.
And that is quite interesting. So I remember, you know, before you guys are around, is taking a screenshot of the Amazon search results, right? And I would then find the seller with the worst reviews and the highest price or the worst price, the one that looks the worst, right? I would then replace their image for my image and then send it out to a few other people, because like changing the titles with like Photoshop, it was just, you know, it's a massive pain trying to get the typeface right so it looks real is really, really tricky, right? So there was a flaw to that where I could only really change a couple of things, the image, maybe the number of ratings and the price, and ask anything after that was just like out of my skill set. So the thing that I really like about the search simulation is that you could actually go in there and go, well, let's make us 4.2 stars. Let's see what would happen if we were to take our listing as it is right now, and we're 4.3 stars, and we put it to 4.2, what's going to happen with our click-through rate? And if you see a dip off, you're like, oh my God, well, maybe we need to focus more on getting some good reviews so that we stay above 4.3 stars. So there's a variety of different ways that you can use that data to make informed decisions about where to spend your money, right? On your, in your company, where to spend your marketing dollars. So that, is it on imagery, or is it on, you know, a strategy to get more reviews, or whatever it's going to be. It's one of those things that I wish I had this. I wish I had that level of sophistication with testing years and years ago. Because I think that gives you such a competitive advantage. And I think it still does now. And to the point where in the last, I guess, 6 months or so, which is why I've been talking about you guys quite a lot, it's just like, well, why should we only use this in optimization? This should be used in development, in really in product development, brand development, so that we can actually do contextual testing on Amazon with our brand and product that doesn't exist yet. So that we get the data, we can then make the changes before we've spent any money on the product, any real money at least. And if that's going to be the color of the packaging or the text that's on the packaging, let's try and get that sorted before we've even had the packaging designed properly. And we know that it needs to be red or gray or green or have multicolors or have a big word across the front. Let's do that testing first and then go into production after we've done all that testing. Do you see a lot of people do that, or is that maybe a little bit more niche at the moment?
One interesting aspect was just, so I feel like in general, not enough people do that for sure. Like a lot of people will come to product pin like, oh yeah, I have my product developed and I'm good to go. I just ordered 1,000 units and that sort of thing. And I was like, okay, I mean, it's fine. We can start there. But how much more valuable can it be if you actually had some data going into production, right? So, and one aspect that actually did surprise me, how many people were using the Pinion videos to get feedback on prototypes. So the way we market Pinion videos, it's like, yeah, put in a URL. And actually now we have a newish feature where you can actually create a URL based on Amazon products. So you don't even have to have a live URL. Some people were doing is sharing a Dropbox link or a Google Drive link and just uploading even drawings. People were telling me that they just drew what they wanted their product to be, that sort of thing. Some people have CAD drawings or whatever. And then just getting actual qualitative feedback, people just expressing what they liked about the drawings, what they don't like, or even asking people, like, how do you think this will fail, right? People's brains, it's very easy for people to get into the, hey, I think this is crap because X, Y, Z. Like, and it's very easy to do that for somebody you don't know. Mm-hmm. So I love that use case. And I think that, yeah, more people should be doing that just to make sure that you're dealing with that product. You're involved with the product development so much that you have the blinders. You stop seeing things that you should be seeing. And you ask 10 strangers what they think of your prototype, and you will get so much information that it'll make it that much more likely to be a success when you actually go to launch it.
They don't care if they hurt your feelings, because then they don't know who you are. They just see, here's the link, here's my feedback, this is what I think. I don't care, I'm getting paid, so it's all good. And it's the immediate thing that comes to a lot of sellers' mind is, well, what's the cost of doing this, right? And the right question to ask is, what's the cost of not doing it, right? If you're spending a few hundred dollars, right? And I should be on your payroll, basically, right? I'll be the marketing director. Yeah. What's the cost of not doing it? Because, but I've seen people time and time again, they've created something like packaging or logos that just, it doesn't translate to customers. They think it looks good. Their mum thinks it looks good. Customers don't want to buy it, right? And if they just done a little bit of testing, even just a small number of testing, any element of testing whatsoever, in fact, they could have identified those issues before they'd spent, you know, thousands on stock, where you're locked into that for a long period of time. And it's like anything, like would you launch a product without doing keyword research? No, of course you wouldn't. Like, you just wouldn't do that. Would you launch a product without PPC or like knowing anything about, like, no, you wouldn't do that. It's something that you would do. And I think that one thing that we can do through like this podcast and talking about it is just give it a little bit of exposure to people that are struggling on Amazon, right? Thinking, well, how can we improve? I don't want to do something and have a negative effect. What are some of the small things that I can do? And this is when you realize that moving a product from the center to the right-hand side of the screen can make you more money. And as soon as you get that light bulb of like, oh, damn, it's actually not this horrible, challenging thing. It's tiny changes can over time have compound massive, massive, massive wins. So I think I've got two questions, okay? My second to last question is, taking everything we talked about today, I want to make more money on Amazon. What's three things that I can do this month that are going to help me make more money?
Oh, this month. Okay. So I was thinking even long-term. So where I've had a lot of success is, can you use better materials? So in the product development, or if you already have whatever product you have now, can you think about like, can you make a higher end version of it? So can you make, you know, instead of just genuine leather, can you go top grain leather, full grain leather? Instead of aluminum, can you go stainless steel? Like, materials are just, you know, what other extra things can the product do to justify a premium price? Because they're, you know, to manufacture with the premium price is never much more in comparison to what your retail price can be. So immediately, how you can make more money, you know, think luxury when you're selling the brand, and position it as such, right? So all of your, do an audit of the brand, you know, is there anything that you can make it feel that people are getting more value out of it? One of my favorite reviews that I've gotten on Amazon, it's only, what is it, four words. And the review was basically expensive, but worth it. And I'm like, holy crap, that's exactly how I want my products to be positioned. I want them to be expensive, but I don't want people to feel like they got ripped off, because then obviously they're going to leave negative reviews. And that's been kind of like my guiding principle for product development. How do I get a little bit of luxury in there? To make more money on Amazon, another way is to get people's information. So again, this might be a little bit more longer term, where you have to get product inserts that actually get people to want to give you their information. So not just like, hey, you know, register for your warranty, put your email address in there. One of the best converting ways to get people's emails is like actually sending them another product. So if you can figure out a complimentary product that fits in an envelope, I'm not sure how it works in the UK, but like in the US, Canada, as long as it's within 2 centimeters or like just 3/4 of an inch, I think it is in the States, you can just send that with postage. So yes, there was one client, they were selling kids' shoes, and they had a whole bunch of flip-flops, kids' flip-flops. So the opt-in in the package was basically like, hey, would you like a free pair of flip-flops, right? Super, like, yes, well, including shipping, right? You're including shipping. And then you'll get their email, you'll even get their address, right? And then once you have that, that's your other way to make more money. So you acquire, you know, you spend maybe $1 on postage, maybe $1 for the product, another $1 for handling, whatever. So $3, you're acquiring the email, the address of an actual buyer, not just a prospect, of a buyer that spent money with your brand. That's insane. I would take as many of those as possible.
That's a good one. And if you were doing a like a subscribe and save product, or any repurchasable product, this could be where you could really then get that customer off of Amazon and onto your own subscribe through your Shopify site, because we know that the churn rate through subscribe and save will be a lot higher than through your own website, right? So if I was doing a supplement of some sort, then maybe I could say, hey, look, we'll send you another 30-day supply completely for free. We get their email, and as part of that, we can then upsell them to a subscription literally at that point, because we're sending them a new one. And yes, there's going to be a cost to that, but those subscribe products, we know that if we can acquire a customer long-term, we know the value of that customer, then actually these things don't become a cost. They become just a marketing expense, right? Of getting a subscriber. And obviously over the period of months and years, you understand how valuable that is to you. I think that's a really, really good tip. Definitely a good long-term tip to add some serious value to your business, right?
Absolutely. And then in the short term, of course, testing, right? There's no better way to make more money right away, but making sure that main image is optimized for more clicks can turn into conversions and more sales. So obviously, yeah, going, especially holiday season, you could literally be selling, and I get this feedback from other sellers that are selling like things that are not gifts. Like, everything goes up. People are just spending more money, whether it's for gifts, whether it's just for household spending. I know one client that makes hinges, for example, and during the holiday season, for some reason, he gets a surge in sales for door hinges of all things. So yeah, now's the time to be testing, to making sure that your main image is on point. And then for conversion, ask 10 people, what's stopping you from buying this product or from recommending it to a friend or family member? And then all of a sudden you have a list of golden things that you can, objections that you can now know that you have to overcome to increase your conversion rate for your particular listing.
Amazing. Three incredible bits of advice there. Last thing that we'll leave on is more of just speculative, right? We've seen a lot come out over the last few weeks with Amazon Accelerate, and this year we've seen Cosmo and Rufus and all this kind of this cool stuff coming out. Where do you see Amazon selling going in 2025? Where should we be really looking and focusing on as sellers?
Yeah, so I mean, like optimizing for the new search. So Amazon's obviously going all in for Rufus. There's a ton of things that we could be doing, and that could be a whole other episode on yeah. on what we could be doing to optimize for AI. I feel like that's going to be a strong point. I hope that Amazon's going to be. I mean, you know, it's kind of like the million-dollar dream, but I hope they're going to also realize that they're starting to get real competition from TikTok Shop and, you know, Temu, Shein, whatever it is. They're really going to have to kind of cater better to sellers. And we've kind of seen that. They've kind of promised some things at Accelerate that, like, you know, it's just going to get better for sellers. And I'm excited for that. Like, I'm excited for more competition because, you know, more competition means they have to. They kind of have to be a little bit more helpful for sellers. So, yeah. That and basically just AI, making sure that your product images can not only be read by humans, but read by AI. Tons of tools. We have a free tool called ImageCheck, check.com. Doesn't cost anything, obviously, no opt-in. You throw in your image and it just basically uses Amazon's recognition to spit out what the AI sees. And it's actually interesting in some cases, you know, if there's a mismatch between what you want people or what you want the AI to read and what it actually is, maybe it's something that you want to shift and optimize. So
maybe it's a bath mat, but it thinks it's a rug, and you can then think, yeah, let's put a swing tag on it and say bath mat, and put the word in there.
Yeah, there was one product. It was supposed to be a stroller cover, right? Like a cover for a sun cover. And we put the snooze shade. I thought it was like an e-scooter. The snooze shade. Yeah.
It's a really good example of that, because especially when Rufus is, and I used Rufus for the first time the other day, and it was very good, but it was giving me options not on the first page, right? And that's a good example where, you know, Cara, who founded Snooze Shade, she could be missing out on tons of sales, particularly going into the future, because Amazon doesn't know what her product is from the recognition standpoint. And just changing one thing, putting a swing tag on and literally saying, this is the product. And then it goes, oh, okay, cool, right. Okay, now we can maybe index you, right? Or we won't change your browse node just because, you know, we want to. And like, we know that the impact of those changes, but I think a lot of sellers don't even know what recognition is or how to access it, you know, having an Amazon Web Services account and being able to access it. So it's cool that you guys have got that tool where people can just go and access that freely. I think that's amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. And that was the complaint that we heard, like, oh, I have to go make an AWS account, which is like a process in of itself. Now it's like, it just straight up grabs the API from recognition. So you don't have to, make an account, nothing. You just upload the image. You're good to go. So, I mean, yeah, for me, 2025 is going to be about not just optimizing for people, you're going to also have to optimize for the AI.
Nice. Amazing. Perfect. So thanks again, Matt, for helping us survive Amazon. And now if you've liked this episode and found it helpful, please do share it with other sellers that would find it helpful as well. Subscribe, comment, like it, so we can continue to help other sellers survive on Amazon. Thanks again, Matt, and see you all very soon. Bye-bye.